next speaker is Brayden. He's going to talk about negative and maskless black holes in physical space.
Okay, cool. Thank you. Okay, yeah. So I'm Brayden Hall. Thank you for coming to my talk today. So this is a talk about, like Jose said, negative mass black holes in De Sitter space, which is sort of a small side project that came out of some of my master's work that I did with my supervisor, Rob Mann. So tail end of the talk, I'll just give just a little bit of background and some motivation behind the work. I'll talk about Lovelock theory, which is where these black holes are existing, these black holes itself, which we're calling exotic black holes, and then I'll discuss the different masses that they can obtain, and then I'll just give a brief summary about what's gonna happen next with this work. Okay, so everyone here probably knows about black holes, but let's just all get on the same page to start with. So I think everyone here would agree that black holes are pretty interesting and exciting objects, even though they're quite strange in some of the properties that they possess. And in particular, singularities, event horizons, and of course, we could have closed time-like curves for Kerr black holes. Now, when you're talking about black holes in general relativity, the event horizons always have constant curvature structure, be it spherical or hyperbolic. But when you move into higher curvature theories, you don't need to necessarily satisfy this condition. And so that's what these exotic black holes do. Instead of being constant curvature event horizons, the event horizon is just described by some arbitrary Einstein space. And the reason that this sort of paper or this work came out was because of exotic black holes that I were examining where the event horizon is non-constant curvature in thermodynamics. So, I specifically, in my master's work, looked at exotic black holes, their thermodynamics in Lovelock, Gauss-Bonnet, anti-De Sitter gravity. And this is just a figure, one of the results from the paper I did with Rob Mann. And what we found was that event horizon geometry greatly affects thermodynamics. Now, this isn't necessarily anything new. People have studied black holes in anti-De Sitter space and their thermodynamics for quite some time. And they've shown that depending on how you set up your transverse space, you can get different thermodynamic phenomena. But what we showed was that if you have an arbitrary transverse space and you change the geometry of the event horizon, you can greatly change the thermodynamic effects. And this is one of the main ones that we found, which was sort of the most important one, was this novel triple point, where you could have a large black hole and a small black hole and radiation, anti-De Sitter radiation, all coexisting at some triple point for a given temperature and pressure, the same way water does for ice, steam, and liquid water. And so once we did this work, the next step was, okay, well, why don't we look at the thermodynamics in De Sitter space, which is sort of becoming a growing area of research. And before looking at the thermodynamics by itself, Rob just asked me, he said, well, how about you just look and see what these black holes look like without any thermodynamic considerations? And what I found was that you can have negative mass solutions. Okay, so Lovelock gravity. So Lovelock gravity, most generally speaking, is just a generalization of Einstein gravity into higher dimensions that allows for higher curvature terms in your action. And the action for a Lovelock theory is given here, where these alpha hats are your Lovelock coupling constants, so how strong each term contributes to your theory. And then LK are what we call the Euler densities. And those are just contractions of the Riemann tensor with the generalized Kronecker delta. And so L0 is 1, L1 is the Ricci term, and then L2 would be the Gauss-Bonnet term, et cetera. And of course, if you want to have some matter term in your action, you can have that as well. So if you vary this whole action here with respect to the metric, you can arrive at the Gauss or the Lovelock field equations, which are given here, where again, same coupling constant alpha. On the right side, you have the stress energy tensor that's corresponding to your matter. And then GAB are Einstein-like tensors, which we call the Gauss or the Lovelock tensors, which are given again by just some form of contractions with the Riemann tensor and the generalized Kronecker delta. And the nice thing about the Lovelock theory of gravity is that when you take the variation with respect to the metric of the action, you get the field equations that they remain at most second order. in the metric. So they're mathematically nice to work with. Now, some people might ask, well, why do we care about higher curvature theories? What's wrong with general relativity? Well, you can thank the quantum gravity people and the string theorists, which suggest that you're going to have some corrections in your action to include nonlinear terms. Now, in this particular talk, I'll focus explicitly on when we have k equals 2, so we're in a second order Lovelock theory, and that must mean your dimension must be greater than or equal to 5. And if you don't have your dimension greater than or equal to 5, then the Gauss-Bonnet term, the quadratic term in the action, is just topological. It's a total derivative, and it won't have any effect on the field equations itself. Okay, so these exotic black holes, what are they? Well, like most theories, you make some sort of an onslaught about what your metric's going to look like, and that's the one that we use here, which was sort of first proposed by Dottie and Gleiser in like 2005, and then more recently by Soria Ray, which is what my work is based on. And IJ, just run over time and your radial component, and then alpha and beta are just the coordinates that you choose for your transverse space. And so more explicitly, this is the metric form that we work with. And so this right here, this d sigma squared, is what our transverse space is. And so when you're at the event horizon, right, the event horizon is described by this metric. Okay, so what do you do once you have some sort of a metric? Well, you throw it into the field equations. Now, like I said, I'm not actually going to be working with any matter terms, so my field equations are just going to be equal to zero. And the important distinction here is how you define what this d sigma squared transverse space is. And there's two options. The first is to be of a constant curvature space, which is parameterized by kappa. So it's either plus one, minus one, or zero, which corresponds to spherical, hyperbolic, or flat geometry. And if you do that, to satisfy the field equations, your metric function f must satisfy this polynomial. If it doesn't satisfy this polynomial, your field equations aren't satisfied. So just some terms to clear up here. So m would be the mass defined through ADM formalism. G is just your Newton's constant in whatever dimension you're in. The sigma d minus 2 is just the volume of the constant curvature space itself. And then again, kappa is the same parameter described here. So, and then alpha k is just a rescaling of those Lovelock coupling constants. So given your order, the order of your Lovelock theory for k, you solve for f and you have the full solution. Now, the exotic black holes are when you assume that this d sigma squared is just an arbitrary Einstein space. That means its Ricci tensor is proportional to its metric. And when you do that, you arrive at a different polynomial for f. It looks similar. Everything on the right is similar. But the only thing that's different is there's this new bn term, which we refer to as the topological term. Some referee didn't exactly like that term, but we've stuck with it. And basically, it just arises in the field equations from the contributions of your transverse space. And so it just it just tells you how the transverse space is its geometry being positive or negative. And it can take on any value that it wants. So yeah, it's not restricted to being these three values, just like the kappa is. It can kind of be any value you want it to be. And then here, there's just some showing what the rescaling of the coupling constants are. You always set alpha 1 to 1 so that you have the proper limit for Einstein gravity. And then lastly, because I'm going to be talking about De Sitter space, this is how we define the cosmological constant. So it's related to the zeroth order Lovelock coupling constant. Okay, so for Gauss-Bonnet, exotic Gauss-Bonnet black holes, this is the polynomial f once you expand it. And you can see alpha 1 is set to 1 already. And then you give this equation to any 10th grader, they can tell you what f is. It's a simple quadratic, and where the only difference is the plus or minus. And we've just rescaled m here just for mathematical convenience. Now, the plus or minus separates the solutions as you take the limit as alpha 2 goes to 0. So the plus branch we refer to as the Gauss-Bonnet branch, because there is no smooth limit as alpha 2 goes to 0. And then when you're in the minus branch, we refer to that as the Einstein branch, as there is a smooth limit. Now, using the definition of the cosmological constant on the previous slide, we can insert it into the Einstein branch, because that's the one we'll be working with. And we've also set B1 equal to 1, so that in the proper limit, we get the Einstein solution. As well, we have a set of dimensionless variables here, such that we can remove alpha 2 from the equation itself. And that yields sort of the final metric function for Gauss-Bonnet, Lovelock, De Sitter gravity, given right here. Now, with that, we can determine the potential horizon locations by setting f equal to 0 and solving for x. And it works out to be just a nice polynomial at the top. Now, as I said, you can be in 5 or greater dimensions when you're dealing with Gauss-Bonnet. But what Dottie and Gleiser showed back in the early 2000s was that if you're in the lowest dimension possible, you can actually only have a constant curvature space. So in order for us to not be restricted to our terms to be restricted in any way, we look explicitly when d is greater than or equal to 6. And then if z is sort of the term that's proportional to the cosmological constant, so for De Sitter space, it has to be positive. Now, what you can do with this without actually specifying any parameters yet is you can use Descartes' rule of signs, which tells you the potential number of roots of an equation. And it can be summarized neatly right here. And so the important part about this is that you can have negative mass solutions and still have potential horizon locations. Now, just because you have horizon locations doesn't necessarily mean you have a black hole. What you need to have is you need to have your metric function f be positive for some x greater than what your event horizon would be. If that's not satisfied, then you don't actually have a black hole. And one more thing that you can do with the metric before anything else is, because there's a square root involved, you could find when you potentially have imaginary numbers arise and when f becomes complex. And so when f becomes complex, when this polynomial here is satisfied. And another thing as well is this location for f becoming complex is also the same location where a full space-time singularity will occur. And we found that from just analyzing the Kretschmann scalar. Okay, so positive mass. So if we deal with positive mass for a second, the dimension, or all the parameters are just outlined here in the bottom. And just a reminder, this is what f is. If you make a plot of f versus x, so on this far left figure, you have no black hole, and you actually have a naked singularity at the origin. And that's for when we set this B2 term to be negative 2. Now, if B2 is positive 2, right, what happens is this function sort of shifts up the graph and then takes on this form here, where now we have two horizons. We have x plus, which would be the event horizon, and xc, which is the cosmological horizon. So this would just describe sort of a standard De Sitter black hole. Now, staying with the positive mass, you can also do something where you hold B2 to be fixed. So this is just some arbitrary value I chose. There's nothing special about it. But if you vary the amount of cosmological constant you have, on this leftmost figure, you have space-time singularities occurring because f has become complex. So it sort of becomes discontinuous here and here. So if someone was living in this space, they'd be living here on this positive, but they would have some sort of a naked singularity right here. That's not good. That doesn't work. So what happens? Well, if you turn up the cosmological constant a little bit, what happens is these two branches that are, you know, split, they start to come back down onto each other, and then they just form a nice De Sitter black hole again. So this happened when I kept B2 term fixed and I changed what the cosmological constant parameter was. But this also happens if I were to keep this fixed. If I increased my B2 even more, I would have the same sort of breaking effect. Okay, so negative mass, sort of the important part. When you have negative mass and all the parameters are outlined here, the leftmost image we call sort of a standard De Sitter black hole. That is, we have an inner horizon, an outer horizon, or the event horizon, and a cosmological horizon, and we have some positive range here. So somebody could live on here and have no naked singularities, and everything would be fine, because the space-time singularity occurs over here. This is where f becomes discontinuous. Now, if we change B2, so for in the center, it's negative 3. What happens is we've lowered f, the function f, and now our cosmological horizon and event horizon correspond to the same location, which, if you were to talk about just regular De Sitter space, is sort of the nary-i solution, meaning the maximum mass solution of that space-time. And then if you increase B2 for the right image, you make the inner horizon and the event horizon location at the same position. And that's what we call an extremal black hole. Now, from the previous slide, we could see there was a certain allowed range of B2 for some given M and Z where you have a valid black hole solution existing. And the question was, can we get a closed form expression for this? And the way that you do that is you have to find the locations of the potential double roots. So when this goes, when this this vertex goes down, or when this vertex goes up, those are the double roots that explain the range. So you simply need to just solve this set of equations. And from the first equation, which is just the horizon equation, you get an expression for what your B2 values are allowed to be, where X are the roots of this equation right here. And that comes from the derivative equation. And there's no general form, no general closed form expression for this without specifying any dimensions. So you got to pick some dimensions and see if it works. Now, for, as you can see, if you let dimensions equal 6, you got an issue here because this is a quintic and there's no analytic solution for a quintic with any arbitrary coefficients. So the lowest dimension we looked at or can look at to find closed form expressions is in 7 dimensions. So in 7 dimensions, this is our root equation for F from the previous, or for X from the previous slide, which again is just a cubic in X squared. So we can write it like this. And then we can quickly distinguish what the discriminant is. And if you want to have a black hole that could potentially have the 3 horizons, or the cosmological horizon and then 2 horizons for the black hole, you need to have this discriminant be positive. And with that discriminant being positive, it puts a range on what M can be in terms of your cosmological constant. So if M is not within this range, you will not be able to have a potential black hole that could have 2 horizons and then the cosmological. So therefore, you couldn't actually get a specific range for what B2 is allowed. Now, with this right here, you can make this into a depressed cubic. So then you can express your solutions in terms of cosines and arc cosines. So this is the equation for what X has to be. So this is a solution for X. Or K is just the different parameterization of the solution. So it's either 0, 1, or 2. And what I found from just simply plotting this is that X0 is greater than X1, and X2 is imaginary. So the two roots locations are given by X0 and X1. And so here they explicitly are written down here. And what that allows us to do, because these are the solutions to the root, we can throw this directly into the equation that expresses what B2 has to be. And so if you do that, this is the form here for what B2 has to be. So if you give a value of Z, a cosmological constant, and you put some mass in that satisfies the discriminant condition, then this, and you plug it into here, you'll get two values of B2 that are negative, describing a minimum allowed value and a maximum allowed value. So if you stay within that range, you'll be fine, and you can have a black hole that could potentially have 2 horizons plus the cosmological horizon. And so this is just the closed form expression for the allowed values of B2. So that was one of the interesting things that we found. So satisfying these B2 conditions, you can have a negative mass black hole. Now, one of the last things that we just kind of quickly did last week, actually, was if you saturate from above the discriminant condition, you can actually possess massless black holes. And so if you set M equal to 0 in your metric function F, your root equation is the same for all dimensions. And it's a biquadratic in X squared. So the discriminant's easy to write down, and we have an easy expression for what B2 has to be. And so if B2 is not within this range here, then you will not have a valid black hole solution. And so you can see here, I've just plotted a few different B values of B2. So when B2 is 2 negative, right? Again, naked singularity. When B2 is at negative 2.5, this is where the cosmological horizon and the event horizon occur at the same location. that again would describe the quote nearby black hole, which doesn't make a whole lot of sense when you think about it now because there's no mass. So what does it mean to have a maximum mass black hole with no mass? But it just mimics the nearby black hole. And then if B2 is -1, we have this the standard De Sitter black hole. And you can see that this satisfies the range. This satisfies the range as well. This one doesn't if we specify Z to be 0.1. Okay, now if you also look at when B2 is positive, you also have the possibility to just have massless De Sitter space by itself. So not a black hole, but just pure De Sitter space. And so here on the left, I've just said B2 to be equal to zero. And you can see here, you just have, you know, some cosmological horizon here. And then this function F terminates X equals zero, F is zero. And what you can do is you can say, okay, well, that's good. What can we infer about a potential range for allowed B2s when you have massless De Sitter space? And what you actually can, all you have to do is you all just consider the singularity equation. And so when you do that, it tells us that the potential locations for a singularity occur right here. And so if B2 is between 0 and 1, then you won't have any singularities occur because this will be imaginary. But as soon as B2 is greater than 1, you have a potential singularity location right here. So you have to stay within this range so that any observer living right here won't see any naked singularities. Okay, so to summarize, exotic black holes can possess negative mass in De Sitter space. So this is the first, according to Rob, he's been around a lot longer than I have. He says he's never seen any black holes exist in De Sitter space with negative mass. Now, he showed that you could have anti-De Sitter negative mass black holes back in the 90s, but no one had seen De Sitter space black holes that were negative mass. Positive mass solutions can have non-trivial naked singularities outside of the origin. There always is a space-time singularity at the origin, but depending upon your parameters, you could have one that occurs outside, and it would be a full space-time singularity of dimension d minus 1. Negative mass solutions are constrained by the geometry of the event horizon. So all these parameters that I've been talking about, B2, this topological parameter. So basically what it's just saying is depending on how you make this, the geometry of the event horizon, there may be a point where you can have negative mass, or if the parameter is not right, you actually can't have negative mass. So it's highly selective on the geometry of the event horizon. The closed form expression for the seven dimensions is nice to have because then you can just specifically just plot those functions itself and just show how any particular M and Z contribution can have a negative mass solution or not. And some of the next steps to do with this work, like I said, I was going to be looking at thermodynamics, but because of this negative mass thing, we made it into its own separate paper. So the next step would be to actually just examine the thermodynamics of these exotic black holes in De Sitter space. And then Rob also was able to get an undergrad student for the summer. So we're going to look at some simple projects like the geodesics around these objects with negative mass. How do they converge? Do they converge or do they diverge? And how does the cosmological constant come into play with those, with the negative mass? There we go. That's everything. Thank you.
Okay. There you go. Right again.